This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is jazz singer Bobby McFerrin. He sings with incredible technical facility and theatrical flair. He alternates between the falsetto and bass lines in rock and roll songs, creating the illusion you're hearing more than one voice. He usually sings unaccompanied, but his voice can mimic the sounds of instruments. For percussion effects, he slaps his body. Pop, soul, and jazz standards are part of his repertoire, along with original songs and improvisations. Music critic Francis Davis called him, quote, the most astonishing jazz singer to come along since Betty Carter. While jazz history offers a number of precedents for him, it's impossible to listen to him without flashing back to street corner harmony groups and the mouth sounds with which wise guys in the back row harassed substitute teachers in high school, unquote. From Bobby McFerrin's latest album, Spontaneous Inventions, this is the Lennon-McCartney song, From Me to You.
If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got everything that you want, like a love that's so, so true. Just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got arms that long to hold you and keep you by my side. I've got lips that long to kiss you and keep you satisfied. Ooh, if there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. Send it along, we love from me to you. We love from me to you. We love from me to you.
That's Bobby McFerrin. He started his music career as a pianist and didn't perform as a singer until he was 27. Both of his parents are opera singers. His father, baritone Robert McFerrin, sang with the Metropolitan Opera and dubbed Sidney Poitier's voice in the film adaptation of Porgy and Bess. Bobby McFerrin has compared his singing to acting because he imagines dramatic situations as he performs, yet he told me he sometimes prefers wordless vocals to singing lyrics.
Well, I like wordless singing more. For one thing, it's not as difficult to sing. You know, if you sing a something with words, then it's more difficult to sing some of the high notes and to move around in as easily, you know, if you've got all these consonants getting in the way, you know. And another thing about wordless singing, which I prefer, is then one song that I'm singing can become hundreds of songs depending on how what I'm singing affects the listener. If I should say something like baby, 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 I love you, I love you, I love you, then everybody has the same experience. But if I, you know, then what is that? I mean, that's one song for me, it's another song for somebody else, you know.
Let's talk about a couple of technical things about your voice first, because I think people who hear you for the first time are just kind of overwhelmed at what you're capable of. How big is your range?
3.5 octaves. And sometimes, depending on what happens, sometimes I can kick into maybe 4 octaves or something. You know, it depends.
Did you stretch it? Is it naturally that large?
I worked on a little bit of it. I don't think it was always 3.5 octaves. I think that at, when I first started singing, it could have been 2.5 to 3. But I used to smoke a lot. And I think that when I started singing, I was so conscious of that that I stopped and I was thinking about my diet and things like that. And I noticed, I think within 2 months or so, that my range in, went, you know, increased maybe a major third or so. And I noticed that also on the lower octaves, I had to work down to an E flat. I don't think that I could really sing that low yet, but I worked on that. So there were some parts of my range that I did have to work on.
What do you do to make your voice go lower than it's ever gone before? Stretch your range?
Well, you just think in terms of half steps. I think that I didn't, my goal wasn't the E flat immediately, but maybe, you know, a G and G flat and then F, you know, and sort of working my way down a little bit at a time. And I would just try and visualize these notes and to think low, you know. But I think that now my range, 3.5 octaves, is pretty much set.
You are able to switch in the middle of a song, almost in the middle of a breath, from falsetto to bass line, back and forth like that. Mm. How do you do it? Do you have to think a certain way to get your voice to make that kind of abrupt switch?
Oh, actually, no. It's like it's advanced yodeling is about the best way I can describe it. It's pretty easy to explain. I'm not too sure if women can do this, because usually women sing soprano and alto, and their voices tend to be pretty high anyway. But perhaps some of the, you know, contraltos might be able to do this if they can distinguish between their head voice and their chest voice. I'm speaking in my chest voice for those who don't understand. And then I switch to my head voice, which is this voice. So it's a matter of switching these two voices.
That's great. Do you have to learn how to breathe in order to get enough breath to do the different roles that you do when you're singing a song? Because you sing all the parts when you do a song.
Well, what's important is learning how to breathe musically and incorporating the breath in the music so that it doesn't sound that the breath is disrupting the melodic flow in any way. And that was something that I had to learn, because I used to do these pieces and then I would have to gasp for breath and it always would get in the way, you know, it would disrupt the flow. And so I taught myself how to intone as I was inhaling and then to use the breath in certain parts of a piece so that it sounds like it's just one, it's something that belongs there, you know, maybe like a hi-hat or something, you know.
How can you intone as you inhale?
Well, in Blackbird, I do that. If you could tell where I took a breath, there it's right.
Right. Now, you use your body as percussion sometimes, and it changes the timbre of your voice, too.
Well, actually, it just gives it a little kick. I wasn't always doing this. I play on my chest a lot, and I make these sounds. But there was a time when I didn't do that, and I always felt that there was something missing. And I would notice that whenever I was around a percussionist, the song was playing, I felt elevated somehow. And so I think accidentally one night I started playing on my chest, and I've been doing it pretty much since.
Is there a good bone to hit in order to get the sound that you like?
Well, I pretty much stay up here, which is, I don't know.
Is that the breastbone?
Maybe you could call it the breastbone, yeah. I don't know what you call it. But then sometimes I slap my stomach because that's got a nice little slap to it. And then sometimes I play on my thighs, you know. I play my thighs.
Do you have perfect pitch?
Imperfect.
It is imperfect?
No, it's pretty good, but it's not perfect pitch.
I would have thought that you had always sung, because your voice just seems like a voice that has always been singing. But you really didn't start to sing till, what, you were 27 or something?
Well, no, I became a singer when I was 27. I had been singing around the house, but I didn't consider myself a singer, and there's a big difference. I sang in church choirs when I was a kid, and I would sing some background in some show bands that I used to work with and, you know, travel on the road playing a piano player. And they'd say, okay, now we're going to feature our keyboard player, Bobby Mack, and he's going to sing You Are the Sunshine of My Life or something like that, you know. So I would do a song or two a night, and then I'd be responsible for singing background parts, which I really never felt that I was good at, and I really detested singing background parts.
Why?
They just weren't fun, and usually I would have to sing in a range that I wasn't comfortable in, and I wanted to concentrate on my piano playing, and I couldn't concentrate on piano playing and singing simultaneously, you know.
Bobby Mack's a great name for a
That was the name I used for many years, yeah.
Why did you switch from piano to voice?
I was dissatisfied with piano. I didn't feel like it was fulfilling all my needs creatively. And I couldn't get the piano to do the things that I heard, you know, like bending notes, you know.
You wanted to go, like, between the keys
and
you couldn't get in.
And I couldn't really do that. And I didn't feel that piano—I always had a feeling in the back of my mind that piano really wasn't it.
And was there a big turning point, or?
Well, I was working with, the turning point was when I became a singer in 77. And up until that point, I was still playing piano and I was working with dancers and writing some music for a repertory dance theater in Utah. And I was an accompanist for the University of Utah Dance Department. And I was really getting burnt out on that and I wanted to do something else. And so I was asking myself this question, what do I do now? And I was asking it every day for weeks when I was struck by lightning on that particular day and heeded my inner voice and became a singer.
Did you know offhand what you wanted to sing? What kind of singer you wanted to be?
That was the next process. And I went through all kinds of visualizations and fantasies about what kind of singer I thought I could be. And as a piano player and playing piano bars and singing, you know, in some hotel lounges and things, I played a lot of ballads. And I thought that I could be, you know, a balladeer, another Johnny Hartman or something, you know, with wearing a white suit and a red carnation on my lapel or something like that. I thought I could do that. And I really thought that that's what I was going to do when the image of solo voice came up one day. And I thought it was a fascinating idea. You know, because I had been pretty much taken in by Keith Jarrett's solo, you know, work as a pianist. And I really loved a cappella music and the sort of the lone musician on stage.
Let's play something from your new solo voice album, and which has a couple of tracks that aren't solo right. voice. And this is from the album Spontaneous Invention. We're going to hear one of your own songs, Caramia. Mm-hmm. Would you say something about writing this or about what you're doing with your voice on it?
Well, it actually came up at that moment. I've done it that one time, and that was it.
Oh.
You know, it was a spontaneously invented piece.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is my guest, Bobby McFerrin.
Okay.
Bobby McFerrin from his new album, Spontaneous Invention. And that was Bobby McFerrin's solo voice and Stool. That was the Stool
right.
You were playing. When you started to sing, did you realize the things that your voice was capable of?
Not right away. I was suspicious of it, though, because I can remember taking vocal solos on albums that I would play around the house. And but not until I became a singer, I had the vision, I said, okay, now this is what I'm going to do. I had to rediscover the things that I already knew, you know. And so it took some time, you know, working on some sounds and the range, you know, not only the vertical range, you know, from the lowest note to the highest note, but then the horizontal range too, you know, how your voice can expand, you know, the color range, stuff like that. So I had to rediscover those things because I was thinking about doing solo voice, and so I was aware that I had to throw everything, as much stuff as possible into my performances. I had to use everything that I had, you know.
Did you draw on some things that you had done as a child, just sitting around doing voices to yourself?
Probably. I think they were probably always there, but I was aware of doing it. For example, like, there's this bicycle horn that I've been making for years and years and years, and I've been asking some old friends, well, was I doing this, you know, when we were hanging out together? And I'm sort of getting an idea how long I'd been doing certain sounds, you know. But I'm really not aware of when I started doing a lot of these things, but hey.
Your parents are both opera singers, and coming from a non-operatic background, I could say that to a lot of children, there's something really ludicrous about opera because the voice is so big and, mm-hmm. and formal
right.
and different from the kind of pop music that I think most kids grow up with.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear if it felt that way to you since you grew up hearing it, so it probably didn't sound weird like it does to other people.
I was used to it. In fact, there was, when I was growing up in New York, I think Texaco had a program. They used to sponsor opera in the 50s, and on Sunday afternoons at 2 o'clock on Channel 4, NBC, we used to sit around as a family and watch, you know, Madame Butterfly and Tosca, you know, and all these great operas, Rigoletto, you know, on television. And I just thought it was fascinating, you know, as a kid, you know, seeing the costumes and the colors. And when I was 6 years old, we went to the Met for the first time, and they really do a good job. I mean, because they'll have windstorms, and you can feel the wind in the audience and things, and wow. It was great.
Did you ever want to sing opera?
No. I never felt that I was an opera singer or had that capability.
You know what I'd like to know? I was wondering if any of your friends, especially black friends,
mm-hmm.
Put down your parents for singing opera because it's not, quote, soulful. Do you know what I mean?
I wasn't aware.
And opera is always considered, you know, a very, like, white European
right.
form.
I wasn't anything that I was aware of. As a kid. In fact, I think the fact that both my sister and I respected that so much that we might have carried that into, you know, our circle of friends, and they might have respected it, you know, through us because we had such a high respect for what, you know, my father and my mother were doing, you know, as singers. And somehow it made us feel special in a way. So I don't think that we were, you know, boo-hooed in any way because, you know, our parents were, you know, into opera and things like that.
Did your parents give you any problem for listening to pop or soul music?
Only if it was too loud. That was the whole problem, was we used to just turn the record player up to 10, you know, just turn it up, you know, and my parents would say, that's too loud. We had, both my sister and I played organ in bands, you know, when we were in high school, and the band rehearsals were inevitably at our house because we had a big house, you know. And so my parents would live through that, you know, with the thumping bass and the bass drum and everything. And it was okay, as long as the volume was kept at a reasonable level.
I want to play your recording of I Feel Good, which is the James Brown song.
Ow! Good God, get down!
You do this with some irony as well as love.
Oh,
Yeah,
you know, I'm learning as I do these more and more to just have fun. Because, you know, when I did The Voice a couple of years ago, even as early as just 2.5 years ago, I was so serious. You know, my posture was from a, you know, this is music. I want you to listen. And I would simply sit in a stool. And my attitude was, you know, let's be very, very quiet. And I'm just going to sing. And you listen to what I'm doing. But they never really came out that way, because I discovered as the night would wear on, you know, after about 90 minutes of solo singing, by the end of the night, you know, I was laughing and having just a wonderful time. And at first, it used to upset me. I used to go backstage after the concert and say to myself, Bobby, that just didn't come out the way you wanted it to. You know, you should have gone left when you wanted to go right, or vice versa, whatever. And it just never came out right, you know. And I used to really get on myself because I thought that I didn't have the right attitude for doing solo voice. And I think it was because of the vast effect that Jared had on me. You know, you attend one of his concerts, you know, and you read, I was reading all about him, you know, the respect he demanded from his audiences, et cetera, et cetera. And I was carrying some of that into my concerts. And then I had to wake up to the fact that, you know, I was my own person and what I was doing was totally different. And even though he had a big influence on me, I was not Jared. You know, he was who he was and I was who I am. And I should just simply be myself as a solo performer. So I started getting wackier and sillier and just having a much better time with myself.
And singing James Brown material.
Yeah, and singing James Brown material, et cetera. Even though even way back then, you know, even doing James Brown, I still had this kind of serious attitude about it, you know. But now, shoot, I'm just out there to have a good time.
Let's hear I Feel Good from your first album.
Good, good.
And my guest is Bobby McFerrin.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't do. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't do. So good. So good that I got you. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't do. So good, so good, but I got you. Ow!
Bobby McFerrin. Bobby McFerrin is my guest. The kind of singing that you do is really, there's no one to compare it to. So it's not like people can, oh, market you like they did, blah, 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 or right. produce your record like so-and-so's.
Yeah.
Was it hard to establish yourself when you started doing the solo voice performances? Because there was no other person you could really describe yourself in terms of.
Yeah, we're still trying to do that, too. I have a hard time trying to describe what I do. But the hardest part was, well, believe it or not, I even had a hard time with it. I had to work on convincing myself that I could actually do this and that it was a viable way for me to make a living. Then I felt that I had to convince my wife and my manager that this was a viable way for me to make a living. Then I had to convince the record company that I could do this. So I had a lot of convincing to do. And I'm sure, as I look back on it now, that my wife and Linda both felt that, you know, they believed in me strongly enough that they knew I could carry it off. But for some reason, you know, when you have inner doubts, you think that everybody doubts you. And you can't really do this. So I worked on that for a couple of years. I had to get the confidence in myself. And it took a couple of years for me to do this.
You know, one thing that our listeners might know you for also, which we haven't mentioned, is your 501 Jeans commercial. How did that happen?
I got a phone call one day from, God, I can't remember the guy's name. And he said, yeah, I'm doing the you know, the 501 Levi's series. And you can go into the studio and do whatever you want. And so initially I went to the studio for about an hour and laid down some ideas. And they were close, but not the cigar. And Linda had the intuition of as she was bringing them this tape, of also taking another tune that I had done called Drive, which... I'm gonna get in my car, which turned out to be the Levi's Blues commercial. They said, well, we like this. We really like this. Just put some lyrics to it. Got my 501 Blues, Levi's, you know.
Well, I think what everybody hopes who does a commercial is that the commercial's exposure will introduce new listeners to the records of the performer. Does it work that way?
I have really no way of knowing, but I hope that's what happens. You know, I hope they listen to the commercial and say, well, what is that? And maybe somebody that's, you know, happens to be there says, well, that sounds like Bobby McFerrin, you know, so well, you should go check out his albums.
Okay, well, Bobby McFerrin, I really have to thank you for being here. It's really been a great pleasure to meet you.
Thanks a lot.
My guest has been jazz singer Bobby McFerrin. His albums include The Voice and Spontaneous Inventions. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Ron Carson. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Salat, assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.